513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. You can also email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Mary, how costly is alcoholism and alcohol abuse? How costly is that to society as a whole?
Well, actually, probably one of you guys might be able to answer that better, but...
That's fine.
Okay.
Whoever wants to field it.
Well, they estimate if you look at medical costs and lost productivity, criminal justice, and all of that, we're probably looking at $230 billion a year that is attributable to the abuse of alcohol. Pretty astronomical.
That is astronomical. That's amazing. I would never have thought it would be anywhere like that.
On the other hand, the non-monetary costs are impacted with kids, I'm speaking from their perspective, when they aren't graduating from school, when they aren't showing up for a job, when they've destroyed family relationships. So those are the societal part of the societal costs that go along with it, too.
And Bob sent us a question. Whoever feels comfortable fielding this can do so. Bob says that his son is a resident assistant at a private college, and the first weekend kids are on campus in the fall. Several kids have to go be taken care of because of over-drinking. And he says, you know, once they're away from home, they drink to excess. And his question is, how do we teach these kids early about the dangers of excessive alcohol consumption?
I do think it's important. I know Mary does too, that we talk about it young enough that they're not suddenly exposed to it in college or taught by their peers. But, you know, we believe in teaching low-risk management so that you don't drink until you're 21. And that's backed up by research that talks about how susceptible you are to future addiction when you start early. So it's not like just a bunch of old mom and dads going, don't drink till you're 21. But that, you know, excessive use of alcohol, it can be dangerous in the short run as well as dangerous in the long run.
Right. I was going to add to that, the how you drink is what we're seeing today that is so problematic. The consumption rates, the consumption patterns, the binge drinking that Nan referred to, that that we're seeing as the biggest problem right now.
And, you know, there was a statistic that astounded me. It was from the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. I think they, and I don't know what year this is from, but they said it was close to 59 million people who have participated in binge drinking. And that almost seems hard to believe, but that is a huge problem, isn't it?
It is. We have a group that we're working with in the county. There's several of them across our state that's focused on that young adult age group and the specific problems we're seeing with them, which is the higher consumption rates and the fact that they don't see that as harmful.
The other piece of that is if you go into the department stores, into the board games, in the board game section of most all of our department stores, you'll see drinking games. So that becomes kind of it's formalized drinking games on how quickly and how fastly you can consume alcohol. It becomes a competition. And so it's part of the game and part of the culture.
Yeah, it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it?
Absolutely.
The assumption that all kids are going to drink anyhow.
But you know, I think what Nan said makes a lot of sense. But part of that is adults need to talk to kids about a lot of things, not just alcohol. And so if there hasn't been a process from early on in elementary school of talking to your children about things that are sometimes difficult, that senior year in high school or that week before they go away to the local college probably is a little late, and it's going to be tough to get by.
So parents and teachers really do have a role to play in this whole thing, don't they, as far as educating kids about the dangers?
I do think they do. I do think sometimes as parents, because we're not real wise about the use of alcohol, or we may be uncomfortable with our own use even in the past perhaps. But, you know, really the CDC and most dietary councils nationally recommend that women have no more than one drink a day, that men never more than two, and that you never have more than three drinks in any one setting. So when as a culture we don't talk about low-risk drinking, it's kind of like you either are drunk or you're okay. I don't think we do a lot to educate our kids. But I think as parents, we need to learn to say it. And I guess I also want to make a plug for talking to our friends. I would never allow Mary, like, to walk out in front of a truck, but I'll let Mary drink too much and not say anything to her. So I think we all need to get over whatever this stigma is or uncomfortableness we have about talking about alcohol use.
Those numbers that you were giving, Nan, were those what are considered to be what they would call moderate drinking
levels?
Low
risk to moderate, so that anything above that is considered potentially high risk. And one more plug, for women, this damages women at a huge rate compared to men, even when they consume less. So, you know, go online, take a look at the stats, and change your habits.
It's actually on our website, and we just use the number 012. And it's just easy to remember, 0 for those, you know, groups that shouldn't be drinking anything, 1, 2, men and women. So,
now, we were talking about educating kids about this. Are there programs in high schools other than just like the one they do, the annual program you get right before prom about don't drink, don't drive, that kind of thing? Are there programs on an ongoing basis to help kids avoid drinking and beyond that, drinking and driving? And
we're actually working on integrating all of that stuff across the curriculum in schools. So there's not just, we had ninth grade health, but, you know, we're talking about the neurobiology of addiction in chemistry class, and we're talking about the social aspects of it in sociology or in religion classes, or we're talking about looking at ourselves as a institution of higher education or whatever, and what are our practices that we do, and what message is that sending to our students? Do we have stag nights? Do we sell alcohol at high school and college basketball games or whatever? So we are trying to look at what's the environment that these kids are in, young adults, and what message are we sending about that?
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our discussion. You can also email questions and comments to talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Steve, is this a problem where there's a lot of denial? In the case of the individual, they say, I'm not a drunk. And in the case of society, they say, it's a legal product. There's no problem with it.
Well, I think it goes back to some old school ideas that you had to be laying in the gutter and drinking all day, every day, and that's an alcoholic. And especially with the outset of binge drinking, that's really kind of got a whole different piece. And so I've had clients that I've treated over 20 years who can get up on Monday morning and go to work and outwork any three people Monday through Friday, but Friday at 4:30, it starts, and it continues all the way through until Monday morning. And they get up and go. And they say, but gee, you know, I'm contributing. I go to work every day. I don't miss work. So we have a whole group of folks like that that no one wants to call out on because, gee, it seems like they're productive. That's what they do on their own time. And, yeah, that sends a real confusing message. But when it begins to interfere with those things you do on the weekend, when that is the central focus of your weekend, and that would be true of any one thing, in my opinion, you know, moderation in all things, any one thing to the exclusion of all others is going to be a real problem. And that's where we have some big deals, especially with our kids, especially with rites of passage, and this is the tradition we have at this school. A bigger issue, though, is we have some wonderful parents that are doing a great job, but we also have some parents who'd say, you know what, I'd rather they get drunk at my house. And when you have one parent in a school that throws a party and supposedly everything's going to be okay, then that just creates all kinds of waves for everybody else in the community. But it happens regularly, and we have that underage drinking law, and providing alcohol is a big deal. But it happens in all the schools across the tri-state.
One of the things that we've done to combat some of that, we was working on the social host ordinances in some of our smaller communities. You know, we have the state law. Right. You can always make your laws tougher. So we have two communities. One is Terrace Park and the other is Norwood, who have actually strengthened their social host ordinances for those very situations.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. And Steve, you started to talk about some of the signs that you have a problem with alcohol. What are some other things that you should look for that show that, hey, maybe I do have a problem with this?
Not being able to stop, having blackouts, drinking alone. We talked a lot about drinking as a socialization, but when you begin to do a lot of drinking at home by myself, or that isolation along with the drinking suggests some kind of long-term issues are there. I think when it becomes a ritual, you know, when it happens regularly every day at the same time on an ongoing basis and you can't separate yourself from that, when you begin to experiment between this kind of alcohol or that kind of alcohol, those all become problems. When you begin to look at how much of your entertainment circles itself around the alcohol issue, another big warning sign.
So would you say it's an issue of if it's controlling you and you're not controlling it, it's a problem?
Right.
I do think it's important, too, that we in our families have open discussion, because many times I will think that it's not controlling me, but the feedback of those close to me may paint a different picture. And so I guess I always encourage all of us to try to be open but loving in our feedback about how someone might change when they drink, or how they said they'd only have two and they ended up having five, or, you know, that it is acceptable for us to talk about that, just like we would if I noticed that you had unexplained weight loss or I was concerned about your sleep apnea, that it's not this sacred territory that we're afraid to speak about.
Mary, you hear the expression sometimes, I'm a social drinker. Is there really such a thing as a social drinker? I mean, or is that just people kind of making themselves feel better about their drinking issues?
Well, I think, again, it goes back to serving size and consumption patterns, as we've been talking about. And everyone knows their own body. But when you look at what the standard is, and when we've kind of standardized that and have accepted that as a society, I'm not sure that we're there yet. But we now research now tells us what a standard drink is, A, and how much is okay, whatever is moderation or low risk for you.
Are there resources people can use to figure this out? I mean, anything online that somebody can go to and it tells them, you know, here's a calculator. If I drink this much, it actually means I've had two drinks or whatever. Is there anything like that available to people that they can use?
Well, I do know that it depends on not just the amount, but whether you've been eating along with it and your body size. So that's a standard and that's a guideline. But the National Institute on Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse is also a great resource.
Now, Nan, you brought up several times that we need to be able to talk to people about this issue. And how do you go about broaching the topic to someone who may have a problem? I mean, that can be pretty difficult. From personal experience, you know, I've seen you try to bring it up, and the reaction is, no, that's not I don't have a problem. That's not me. Don't bring that up again. How do you do that?
Well, I think the first thing is to remember that no one chooses to be alcohol dependent or to be an alcohol abuser. So if I can come to you without that judgment and share with you what it is that I've seen that makes me concerned and how I feel about it. So it's not my judging your drinking, but that, you know, I was concerned because at our office party, I saw that you were stumbling into the restroom, or, you know, I'm concerned that you smelled like alcohol, or I know you're on Weight Watchers and you just consumed 12 points of wine. You know, so something that's concrete, but I think whenever we don't come from a place of concern and we come from a place of anger or judgment, people tend not to listen to us. I guess I want to be the one who feels like I said something to you. I hate it when somebody, we have it in the newspaper and there's a car crash and someone's dead and they say, oh, I knew he drank too much. I watched him at the bar. Well, you should have spoken up, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'd say that's true. Steve, is it a case, though, that it's often difficult to get a person to admit that they need treatment for alcohol abuse?
I'm not sure about treatment. I agree with Nan. I think first let's talk about how's it impacting you. And treatment is as wide as it is high. But the first step, and we talk a lot now in the field about stages of change, about pre-conscious decisions, conscious decisions, contemplation, and then action and change. And so you have to be able to, as therapists, I will assess someone in terms of their place in that continuum of stages of change. And so if they haven't seen the issue, now if they have someone like Nan talking to them, we begin to talk about those issues. Gee, are people starting to talk to you about your alcohol use? More than one person. Yeah, they are. Well, gee, I wonder what do you think about that? And so we begin to kind of move them along as opposed to coming in and pounding them hard on the front end where they refuse and oftentimes don't come back. I feel as a therapist and as someone that does a lot of assessments, I really got to sell the program on the front end. I really want them to come back. They don't come back, I can't help them with treatment. And so we really have to walk carefully with that. And each case is going to be pretty unique to itself.
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can also email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's talk with Mark in Columbia, Tusculum. Hi, Mark. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you. And what's your question or comment?
Yeah, so I just had a comment. I know you asked earlier if there's a way, we can find out how much you've been drinking, what its effect on you is, perhaps what your blood alcohol content is. And I know there are a couple smartphone apps and some online programs you can use where you put in your height, your weight, how many ounces of beer you've had, wine, whatnot, and it'll calculate based on those variables your blood alcohol content. So I just thought that that's something interesting one can use to, gauge how much you've had and what's enough for you and things like that. So I just thought that was interesting.
Well, thank you, Mark. We appreciate the comment. And are those a good tool, you think?
I think it's a good tool for evaluating how impaired you are. It may not be a good tool for making lifestyle choices. It did make me think of something with Super Bowl Sunday coming up. If you have your non-alcoholic beverages displayed as well as your beer, people will drink less. It's a big drinking day. You don't even realize that you've been drinking until the game's over. You stand up to cheer and you can't walk. So just as a host, make sure you've got plenty of non-alcoholic beverages for people so that they don't have to be like, oh, can I get a water? Oh, go out in the garage. So just a tip.
Steve, some other tips for that kind of a setting? I mean, she's right. Super Bowl Sunday. I imagine that's a pretty big day for alcohol consumption.
I think to normalize it, especially in my work with people in recovery, they're always very anxious about going out and what will people say. And so, if you have a friend that used to drink a lot that isn't, then leave him alone. God love him. He's doing it by purpose and doesn't want to really be pointed out. And so on big nights like that, it's like, I really enjoy it. Thanks for coming in. It's really great. We're going to have a good time. If he isn't drinking 27 beers like he always did, good for him, and it's going to be okay. He'll still think you are a super host.
So let him be. Mary, when it comes to treating alcoholism, is there a best approach to it? Does Alcoholics Anonymous work for everyone,
I'm not in treatment. I'm in prevention, so I can't. Okay. I can't speak to that.
Okay,
someone else can.
I'm always about. I tell my clients I need to give you as many tools as possible, and certainly AA and the 12-step fellowship has been a valuable tool for 50, 60 years now. It works for the people that want to work it, that need it. Oftentimes, the advantage of it is alcoholics, by the time they get to treatment, have broken their relationships with just about all the rest of their support. And AA, for someone without support, is a wonderful place to start. So I think it's a good tool. It is the only tool for all people.
Is total abstinence the only real way for alcoholics to beat this?
I think alcoholism is a disease, and I think once you have that disease, that abstinence is the way to continue your recovery, just like you would make choices around heart disease. There may be some people who are able to pull back from alcohol abuse, like you get in trouble and you're like, I'll never do that again, and they're able to. I think if you make a promise to yourself and you're not able to do it, you really need to pay attention to that. But and know that alcoholism is a disease you can recover from. And if one way doesn't work, try another, because many, many people live in long-term recovery without having a drink or drug for 10, 20, 30, 40 years.
And Steve, did you want to add to that?
Well, the abstinence piece will ultimately work for those that have to. But early on in recovery, early on in treatment, we'll talk a lot about harm reduction therapy. And so we talk about reducing the amount with the goal of being total abstinence. Because if, in fact, you've been drinking for some period of time and it is a disease and it is chronic, just like diabetes, which means it's going to keep coming up. In the old days, the first time you would relapse, you would go back to use. Many times they'd kick out of a program. We didn't find that to be very effective. And so today in treatment, we start to talk about, can you delay your use? Can you delay the number of use? Ultimately, to be where Dan is, to say, abstinence is going to work, but you kind of got to walk them down the road. We're finding a lot better engagement and therapy on the long term with that approach.
And from each of your perspectives, what does society need to do to address this problem?
Well, I was just remembering of a couple of things that we have going on right now. Well, first of all, changing the norm, as we've all talked about, is changing the norm in our community. We are a German Catholic Irish society with community festivals every weekend. So part of our work is to not make alcohol the focus of a major event or even family events or the Super Bowl. It's like having those other options. Reducing availability is the other one. You know, most of kids get their alcohol from private residences. So if parents are locking it up and monitoring it, and if we are enforcing some of our underage drinking laws, then that's the second step. The third one for us is that perception of harm, elevating that by parents talking, teachers talking, and having that those messages out there that to counter all of the messaging that we hear that's pro-alcohol.
It's okay not to drink, and if you're struggling, recovery is absolutely possible. And if your family is struggling, there are ways that you can interact with them that might make it more likely that they would get help.
I think the big thing is to understand how wide and large the recovering community is. I have old clients. One is a businessman who only does business with other recovering people. That's how wide and large it is. And so when you begin to see everyone inside the recovering community, that stigma goes the other way, because all flavors, size, and shapes are in recovery. So there's going to be somebody just like you once you come into the recovering community.
And thank you all for joining us.
Absolutely.
We appreciate it.
Thank
you. Steve Durkee is the behavioral health outpatient therapist with St. Elizabeth Healthcare, and Nan Franks is the CEO of the Alcoholism and Addiction Council of Greater Cincinnati, and Mary Haig is president of the Coalition for a Drug-Free Cincinnati. You can find links to their sites and their help hotlines at WVXU.org. And after the break, a conversation with the new president of Thomas More College, David Armstrong. And you can join that discussion at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.